Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm joined by the Matts. I've got a thing here that I seem to always end up with you guys or other co-hosts on the show. But this is actually a new Matt and an old Matt. So let's start with the old Matt. Matt, I'm going to call you Matty today. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Mike.
So that's Matt Graham, who obviously works with me and is actually a producer of the VFX show. So we actually owe you an enormous debt of gratitude. Now, I want to introduce our new Matt, Matt Wallen. And Matt, can you say hi and give us a background on how you've come to the visual effects industry?
Yeah, sure. I should say I'm currently a professor at Virginia Commonwealth University in the glorious state of Virginia on the east coast of the United States, and I teach 2D and 3D computer graphics and some photography and cinematography as well. But I come to effects just through my experience at ILM. I was at ILM from 1990, kind of way back when, from 1992 to 1999. And was there for a number of years, and then eventually moved to New York City, where I started a small shop with a couple friends of mine, and did work for the artist Matthew Barney, supervising some visual effects on his Cream Master Cycle project, and then went back to California and worked at a number of other companies. I was at ESC for a time. And at Tippett Studio for a while. I went to Weta for the last about 3 months of King Kong, and then came back to the States and wound up here in Virginia, of all places. I married a Virginian, which is what brought me here.
Oh, excellent. Well, we like marriage. It's a good thing. And I've got to say, I think it was at Tippett, you were on Matrix Revolutions. Is that right? And was that...
That's correct. Yeah, I was Matrix Revolutions at Tippett, and then on Hellboy.
So you have an obscenely offensively cool IMDb set of credits. So I'd recommend people go and check it out. Plus, there's a terribly small shot of you if people want to see what you look like in a what looks remarkably like a Stormtrooper outfit.
yeah, that's one of my that's what I tell some of my students when I'm. Teaching classes, I tell my students that I'm fortunate enough to have had an opportunity, as sort of probably most of the people in this business, you know, who are our age, probably like in their late 30s, 40s, and beyond, or would say they probably got into this business largely because of Star Wars. And yes, I was a huge Star Wars fan.
Though in our case, Matt, that was the first three films. And in Matt G's case, that was the last three films.
Please distance me from the last three films.
But so anyway, Matt, your credits are, as I say, very impressive from literally Star Wars. But there was The Mummy. There was tons of stuff. Watchmen, I Am Legend, Beowulf. But I actually really respect your role as an educator as well. And we're very big on educators and people who put stuff back into the industry. So we... incredibly enthusiastic to have you here for today's Toy Story 3 review, because I think you'll give a really interesting perspective on that film. And as we like to do always, we're going to do a rundown of what the guys think of the film, and then we'll get into what would normally be the visual effects, though in this case, the animation. And I want to gear it, of course, to a comparison between Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 3, just in terms of technical things, because seldom do we get such an amazing slice of a view of technology between two periods. So let's start with our movie review-ish bit. First, and I'm going to ask you, Maddie, what did you think of the film? I'm guessing you liked it.
I did. Look, you know, I always love a good Pixar film, except for maybe Cars, but I loved this film. The story was terrific. Visually, it was stunning. And what a great way to end the series.
Ending the series, a presumptive end, but I think it's probably valid.
I think everyone's been saying it's the last one. And, you know, I got to the end of the film and I'm like, no, one more. Come on.
What do you think, Matt?
I felt the same. I was actually really pleasantly surprised how much I enjoyed the film. To be honest, going into it, I was a little bit reticent, just, you know, three of anything. I'm never really too certain if, you know, the franchise aspect of filmmaking is something that I can really get behind. But, you know, Toy Story 2 was a great follow-up to the original. And I went into this sort of thinking, oh, can they do it again? Are they going to make something that's really going to, you know, fire on all cylinders? And I actually walked out of this thinking that it was maybe even the best of the three.
It's interesting that there's a lot of stuff that could have happened with this film, not least of which is I remember talking to people around the stage that Disney was going to do Toy Story 3 without Pixar. This is pre-merger.
Yeah, and Circle 7 when they were going to do that spin-off.
Well, Paul Dubevic on his Facebook page actually posted a photo of a Rubik's Cube of Toy Story 3 that he got from Disney. This is the non-Pixar version that was never made. And they were actually approaching him, and I'm saying this because it's on his Facebook page, to see if they could use photogrammetry to calculate what the character models were, because Disney had no legal right to get the actual models to the characters from Pixar. And so Disney was thinking they were going to have to reconstruct all the models based on different points of view of the models from different shots in the film. Of course, Paul Dubevic declined. But yeah, that gives you an idea how bad it could have been had Disney taken an aggressive stance. But the fact they actually made kind of props to give away is kind of remarkable to me.
And they did some promo posters and stuff as well leading up to the announcement of them doing that one. It just would have been atrocious, I think. I mean, one of the things that we love about Pixar, apart from their amazing quality of visual imagery, is their stories. They create terrific stories that we fall in love with and characters that we have empathy with. And I think, again, this is one of the major successes of Toy Story 3. It was great in every respect of that.
Well, I wonder, it's funny you guys mentioned that. I was looking at the IMDb site, looking on the page they had for Toy Story 3, and there was a bit on there about, in the trivia section, about a plot that had been written, I think, as part of that, what was it, you said Sector 7 or Circle 7?
Circle 7,
or something?
Yeah.
Circle 7, and the plot that they describe on there was something related to Buzz Lightyear being shipped back to Taiwan and all the toys having to get together and band together and go back to Taiwan. I don't know the factual accuracy of whether or not that was actually a story that was under consideration, but it was an interesting read.
Yeah,
it seems almost like that's what they wound up doing in Toy Story 2, though.
Yeah, I think the other problem would have been whether or not you would have had the commitment from the actors involved. They would have been an under contractual obligation to necessarily reappear. And what's great about this one is that you do have all the original voices. So I think it's, you know, really terrific that didn't happen. It would have been, to me, the, I don't know, Indiana Jones Part 4 of the... I would actually say that Indiana Jones 3, the father and son Indiana Jones, was another one of those films where the third film really, really delivered. And I think that we're all in agreement this one really delivers. Can I just change gears for a quick second, though, and discuss how superb the trailer short was, the short being Day and Night. Now, I think this is something that we're going to get a lot more info on at SIGGRAPH, and there's some talks on it there. I'm looking forward to those. But it was probably the best use of stereoscopic filmmaking for storytelling that I've ever seen. What did you think, Matt?
Yeah, I was actually, it's funny you said that. I made a couple notes after walking out of the film, and that was one of the things that I said. I thought it was just amazing use of 2D and 3D, and I think that somehow that combination of the traditional kind of 2D, almost sort of cell animation, coupled with that extra dimensionality of the 3D inside of the two characters, it really, it gave it a quality visually watching it in 3D that was really unlike anything, you know, as opposed to the other sort of standard, you know, How to Train Your Dragon or the rest of Toy Story 3 or even, you know, something like Avatar. Seeing it sort of coupled with that 2D element in the foreground that you're sort of watching it through, which is also consistently in motion, I felt like it gave it a whole nother dimension that really made it interesting visually, and it really worked, I think, on a number of levels.
It was so incredibly interesting to see that direction, because it wasn't what you call classic Pixar. Classic Pixar being that sort of stylized thing we've seen very successfully done in a lot of films. But what was the short with the bunny rabbit that we loved?
Presto.
See, that was brilliant as well. Slightly different style, but you would have still said it was Pixar-esque. This really wasn't.
I don't know. I think Pixar's depth of talent really, it dates back to hand animation and stuff like that. So I think a lot of the artists appreciate... wasn't Lasseter over at Disney doing hand animation back in the day?
Really back in the day, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, a lot of the artists... I mean, Pixar aren't about just looking to the future. They really appreciate the past and old-school techniques. And all their layout design and all that kind of stuff has a lot of stylistic throwbacks to this kind of 2D stuff. I thought it was beautiful. The combining of the 2D, 3D styling and also the audio, really delivering the gags, and it played a big part. I know Toy Story 3 was, I think, the first film to use Dolby 7.1 audio.
Yeah.
So I'm not too sure if the short would have taken advantage of that and tried to take that to a different level.
I think that the thing about the short for me is that it was both reminiscent of old school animation and the most cutting edge 3D stereoscopic work I'd seen. Mm. It was hard to imagine anybody else finding that balance between going old school and going hardcore new. And there was no 3D gags that were just, you know, the most obvious way 3D gets used. So it was like somebody went, I just had this image of somebody in a meeting and they were like, so now let's imagine the screen is like a window in, and if things are stereoscopically behind the window, it seems like you're looking through a window, and some animator sitting at the side going, window into a character. And then, you know, I don't know if that happened, but I like to romanticize that it did. Okay, so look, let's talk about the film from a stylistic point of view. And I'm going to open with that train sequence for a couple of reasons. One, it's spectacular. But second, I think it was a real visceral moment for me where I went, wow, this is guys I know and love, like old friends, but somebody just amped up the quality setting. And yet, by the same token, they didn't look like they were different characters. It was just the meticulous detail of everything around the characters just seemed to have gone up about a couple of orders of magnitude.
Absolutely, yeah. I would say that was one of the biggest things I noticed right from the get-go, was just the degree to which in that opening sequence, that opening sort of playtime scene, which seems like kind of a staple to to these stories, it just had such a all the material qualities, all the camera work. And I thought also, too, I was really blown away by something that I always kind of have felt like, maybe aside from WALL-E or maybe the last couple of films, but I've always thought that some of the effects animation that I see out of Pixar is never is not often as strong as effects animation out of some of the other big houses. And I thought the effects animation in this, the explosion at the bridge and the whole thing with the pig and the barrel full of monkeys, bomb, awesome. Mushroom cloud, all that particle work and the simulations that were done there, and even later in the film, which I guess we'll get to, but the incinerator stuff towards the end, it seemed like they were they really ramped up all of their effects animation work to a level that I hadn't seen them do before.
Matt, you and I are going to be very good friends. I couldn't agree with you more. For me, that was the production value, because I think what changed is the degree of cinematic, breathtaking shots that we didn't get in the earlier films for technical reasons. It was very hard to do those big exteriors. And while there were some nice cinematic shots under the truck at the gas station and that kind of stuff where it were very low angles, nothing really got close to the cinematic marvel that was that end sequence. From a technical point of view, the particle work was exquisite. I'm the only criticism I have of this film, and it's, God, so minor, is I almost felt like the monkey's big particle system taking over the characters. That felt like it could have been in some other film. It was the sort of thing that other films do, and Pixar's never relied on that. Whereas at the end, I totally am with you. I think that the particle stuff at the end was magnificent. I just felt like it was a bit like we're showing off with the monkeys in the opening. What do you think, Manny?
I think the incinerator would have to be their show off. It was just so beautiful, that bit. But the monkeys, I mean, in a kid's imagination, and that's how we saw it. I think they're allowed license to.
But you know the shot of the train, it comes off the train, looks down, and you see where the bridge is. Okay, so that was Pixar, exquisite detailing, just it had all those. And I know you don't like Cars, but Cars had absolutely gorgeous scenic wide shots of when they left the town and went for their date up in the hills.
I remember watching that shot, you know, as the train's coming close to falling off the end of the track, and I wish they would just pause it there, because it was so beautiful. I just wanted to take it all in for a bit longer. And so as soon as they changed the shot, I'm like, oh no, I want to see more.
Two words, my friend, Blu-ray. I agree. But I think that the monkey collapsing out sort of thing, I mean, I was still laughing from the pig spaceship.
Yes, that
was a cracker.
Tremendous.
And, you know, I've always felt this about Pixar films, and I'm sure you'd agree, Matt. There is just this sense that somebody loved this and took time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I really felt like, you know, that not only did they love it and take the time in terms of, you know, the specific details in every shot, but you can tell just through the construction of the narrative too. I mean, in the fact that, you know, they're doing the whole widget there, you know, they're designing and laying out the entire narrative and figuring out how this is all going to work together. And just that opening scene in particular, that kind of fantastical play and the continued sort of upping the ante of, you know, the kid's imagination, where these sort of, you know, goofy, silly little toys become these huge sort of iconic, you know, the pig spaceship really is the one that stands out as the thing that sort of takes the cake in that whole scenario. And then, yeah, you know, the Buzz Lightyear coming in and rescuing the train at the bottom. And I don't know, just it was such a... you know, uplifting thing, and it really does in a very nostalgic way for, you know, any of us who are, you know, parents or just remember being a kid and playing with that kind of free imagination. Seeing something executed so well with such care and detail and focus on story, it was so tight all around.
I think they had the opportunity to do that this time, finally, because, I mean, Toy Story 1 was the first computer animated feature film, and, you know, pioneering and amazing. And if you still great to watch these days. And then Toy Story 2, what, they only had 9 months after throwing the initial script out and starting again and redoing it. So they were in a bit of a push to do that. But obviously, yeah, you're right. They've had the time to craft this and do exactly what they want. And it really shows.
I just felt like this film even kind of, it felt as if it could stand alone. You know, I mean, I feel like it encapsulates all of the thematic elements and qualities that you see in the first two films and all the emotional impact in the first two films. But I think, to me, it just felt like it worked in a sort of all-encompassing way in this film better than it did even in the first two. It was just so strong, although I don't know if I would have had that same reaction having not seen the first two films, but it felt like they really packed everything into this one.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I almost felt like the first film was Buzz's story and the second film was Jesse's story, and the third film actually felt like it was Woody's story more than... Because if you think about the second film, that scene where she does the romanticized remembering of playing... what's the song that's...
I don't know. My little girl's played that song to death a thousand times.
You know, she's swinging around in the sunlight and stuff. Like, that was a real tug at the heartstring moment where even the most diehard, cynical animator was kind of... And in this one, you know, there really was, at the end, when they're all holding hands and it looks like that's it. I mean, people were tearing up. I can't quite grasp how emotionally powerful that was for a fully animated film about toys. Bits of plastic. And people were just really... And I don't know. I think there was more of a journey. So everyone had like their own play. Yes, there are some plot similarities between them. But you'd have to say they weren't revisiting the same gags either. So the amount of humor they managed to get out of that Ken doll... was nobody's business, but they weren't doing it at, you know, at the expense of just replaying all the previous gags.
Yeah, I mean, there were some little homages back to and story points and even dialogue that was thrown back to the first one, especially in that opening scene, because, you know, we're seeing the same action as the first story film, the first Toy Story film opens with, but then, yeah, again, they've amped it up and just made it awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I think the getting out of the playroom was an obvious homage to the initial Buzz thinking he can fly stunt. I think what I think technically was going on with this film was really interesting is that you couldn't change the fundamental characters that much. Like, Buzz Lightyear has to still look like Buzz Lightyear, and we didn't want him to look like the uber cool, mega textured version that is now possible and make the old one look like it was a piece of old technology, which obviously it was from a just purely rendering point of view. But what I found was interesting, if you go and look at any frames from the original film, the background characters, they just couldn't put much into them. And if you get a frame of the current film, and there are some good high-res publicity stuff, there's so much detail in those secondary and tertiary characters. They really have complexity. They have depth. They have a lot of detailing. And so that enriches, gives you a richness to the whole film. And I think that's what... I don't think that Woody necessarily looks that different, but he's surrounded by people that look more visually complex because the render power allows that.
I think, yeah, I was lost in some of the backgrounds inside the playroom. Just, they're so rich and colourful. And but I think they did actually go back and they had to rebuild all the characters from scratch, model-wise and texture-wise. But, you know, again, keeping the look of the original characters. I guess they just had more flexibility now with things like rigging and texturing. Like Buzz's dancing scene was just... terrific.
That was awesome. Did you have a particular favorite scene from a technical point of view, Matt?
Well, you know, there was a couple things just in talking overall. From a technical point of view, probably the stuff that really stood out for me, a couple things. One of them, there was all the lighting that took place in the scene that took happened in the snack machine where all the toys at the, what is it, Sunny, what's the name of the place? Sunny Time or... But the lighting in there I thought was really great. And also there's a scene where they're riding on the back bumper of a pickup truck in the rain. I think it's the Lotso character and the clown or something. And
yep.
Yeah.
I thought that was really amazing. And then, but what really kicked it over the top for me was the stuff that happened towards the end, the trash truck in the fog and sort of the volumetric lighting that they had going through some of the fog and that stuff. There were moments where watching that, it looked like they'd all of a sudden cut to a different movie, and there was this sort of photorealistic, you know, computer rendered trash truck coming down the alley, coming to pick up the dumpster. And that stuff really stood out to me just visually.
Yeah, I guess I felt the same way when they amped it up at the end for the trash scene, like after that one with the pickup truck, when they actually were in the just after the conveyor belt and they were sliding down the ridiculously large furnace thing. But at that point, I forgave them because it emotionally worked to amp it up. You know, it was so beautifully rendered, but it was such a complex scene.
I made a note, though, that I thought there was a really interesting thing that happened visually over the course of the entire film. I think there was a really interesting visual progression that I don't know if you guys saw this or if this was just sort of my imagination, but as I sat there watching the film, it felt like, you know, the opening scenes that we were describing, the sort of, you know, the playtime scene and stuff were really great and very reminiscent, although much more sort of... technically at a higher level than the first two films, but it felt much like the first two films did visually. But I think as the story went further, it felt as if the palette became sort of darker, a little bit grittier, a little bit more steeped in a kind of almost photoreal quality. And then towards the close of the film, we sort of went back to that more original look. And I don't know if you guys felt like that was something that was going on, but...
Yeah, no, definitely. By the time we went back to the final play sequence, that had almost retro feel to it in comparison to the realism of the junkyard, if that's what you mean.
Yeah. It felt like that there was a progression that was sort of taking place through the narrative. And the whole thing that sort of started to happen during their... and it seemed like they were sort of dealing in the great escape, you know, or like an escape from Alcatraz kind of scenario where they had all the characters at the... at the daycare center as they're working towards escaping, the march music they had playing in the background and stuff, and sort of the pace of the narrative and the fact that a lot of that stuff took place at nighttime too, I thought was sort of a departure from the previous two films.
It was dark without being frightening.
That baby character was dark and frightening, but...
I'm going to fess up here for two things. The first thing I'm going to fess up on is I didn't laugh harder than I did over the tortilla Mr. Potato Head. I don't know why I found that. I was crying laughing. I mean, that just was... I don't know.
You and my six-year-old son thought that was the funniest scene. My son actually burst out laughing louder than I've ever heard him laugh in a movie when Mr. Tortilla Head came on screen.
Yeah, and he's walking along the window, and there's a bird there, and I swear to God, I was just crying laughing. The other thing is I'm really nervous to kind of critique the film from a cinematography point of view, because last year at SIDGRAPH I heard about the cinematography for Up, and the depth of referencing of other live-action films that went into that, the thought behind the process, they were discussing the fact that they were looking at Japanese films from the 50s. There are just so many devices for square versus circular and how they would make a character feel like they had less room by placing them with parallel lines either side to kind of box them in versus when characters were not emotionally connecting, they wouldn't let them overlap in frame. But when they were emotionally connecting, they'd have a shot where, you know, you see over the shoulder of one character onto the next, but physically they were overlapping.
It's like a freakishly sophisticated visual language that they've set up there.
And the trouble is, I honestly believe this to be the case, it was so good that I couldn't concentrate on that stuff. I was just wanting to know what was going to happen next in the plot. And so here am I meant to be some kind of sophisticated guy reviewing it, and I was just rooting for the guys and wanting to see, you know.
The pace of the film was definitely a constant. You know, one thing led to another, and I was almost exhausted by the end of it. I was going to wonder later whether or not the 3D had a part to play in that. But yeah, I was exhausted by the end of it and loved every moment, though.
Let's talk about the 3D. Matt, did you notice the 3D, or was it immersive?
I actually think it was fairly immersive. I'll be honest, weighing in on the great debate of our current era, I guess. I'm not a huge fan of stereoscopic, which in some circles I know is blasphemy. But, I felt like certainly in the short, the 3D, as we were discussing, I thought was really just amazing. And it was used to great effect in that you know, as part of the conceit of the whole design of that story. But in the film itself, I mean, it was hard to fault it. It was really great looking, and I don't know if I feel like it's a film that you could go back, and I could certainly go back and watch this a number of times. I think I was sort of with you, Mike. I had a hard time getting away from just the story and looking at it from a technical point of view. I kept every once in a while seeing something and sort of making a mental note to myself, like, oh yeah, that's really interesting what they've done there, and or that looks really cool. Or, but I was so caught up in the story, it was sort of hard to detach from that. And the 3D, I think, was immersive in that way. I didn't ever see it falter, really.
What about you, Matt?
Yeah, I definitely found it immersive and successful in what it was doing. I know, obviously, 3D is getting bigger and bigger, left, right, and center. I think there's now about 5,000 screens in America, mainland America, and so it's definitely got that impact. One thing I noticed a couple of months ago when we saw How to Train Your Dragon, my 4-year-old daughter got a pair of kids' glasses, which, you know, helped her a lot in that watching the film. But when we saw Toy Story 3 yesterday, she didn't get a pair of kids' glasses. And I think that's something that takes the kids out of the film and is a struggle for them to appreciate.
I didn't see this film with kids. I have kids, but I saw a press screening. So tell me, you both did. So I'll start with you, Matt. Did she stay engaged with the film this time or not?
She did, but got more restless in some of the darker scenes. And also, I think the glasses were really annoying for her. Right. So I think if you're going to be pushing such a huge thing and big ticket prices on 3D films, you have to, cater for the kids.
She's four.
She's four, yeah.
Okay. Now, you said your son was with you at six, is that right?
Yeah, my son is six, and he was really excited to see this movie, although he was not a fan of the first two Toy Story movies. He has them but has never really watched them. And he came and he saw this film. He was excited to see it. He was mostly excited to see it when I told him there were going to be some little green army men in the movie. And he got the kid-sized glasses and he sat down and watched the film. And he was totally engrossed in it. And he laughed extremely loudly during the tortilla scene, and when he comes out as a pickle or something later on, or a cucumber from the garden. And he thought that stuff was great. He loved the potato head characters. And upon getting home that afternoon, he wanted to dig out the Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2 DVDs and watch those. And he's been obsessively watching them since we saw the film a couple days ago. So,
I mean, I have daughters that are sort of closer to the 8, 12-year-old kind of range. And they enjoyed Train Your Dragon. They also enjoyed, for that matter, Shrek 4, which I must admit I actually fell asleep in. but I was not reviewing it for technical reasons. But I think the thing is, I expect they'll just love this to death. They did grow up, though, with Toy Story 1 and 2, and they got so played to death in our household. I think almost, though, they... I think the 3D thing works for them, and I think that only the older one really likes the 3D. The younger one sort of just is okay with the 3D, but not a big deal to her. I think this film would work just as well in 2D as in 3. I'm going to see it, I guess, again in 3D, but I don't think I would have a problem with this in 2D.
No, I think the story's still there, the quality of the animation and all these key things are still there. The 3D on this particular film is just, you know, an additive.
I would have killed myself not to see Day and Night in 3D,
yes,
short, but I think I could see the main film, as long as it was a good print in... that was rendered at 1920 by 1080 in dual stereo, so that's what it was mastered as. Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, do you guys know, I looking at the IMDb page, it says that it's the first Pixar film to be released in IMAX. Do you know if that's correct?
Yep, there's a huge IMAX poster at the largest IMAX screen in the world, which is just here in Sydney, and yes, it's definitely going out in IMAX. I don't know if it's being re-rendered for that, though I should find that out.
Yeah, that would be really interesting.
I think that the end sequence deserves a little bit more discussion. The scale of that inferno. We've seen them people going before along a conveyor belt to the chopping machine or the Sherlock Holmes bizarre butchering machine or whatever other darn thing it is. But it was a nice twist that at the end they actually went into this big sliding slide, because it gave you, I think, more gravitas to the emotional scene that they could be sitting there slipping down as opposed to on a conveyor belt with the slightly more comical feel that you get from a conveyor belt sequence a la the conveyor belt in, I don't know, Star Wars or
James Bond kind of,
chocolate thing. Did you agree? I think that end scene, I mean, it seemed a bit weird for the geography of a friggin' tip to me. But apart from that, it really felt like it gave them a good platform to play out the final scene. You could, everyone could look at each other. It was good staging, is what I'm getting towards.
Yeah, I think I would say this. I would agree. I think that whole scene, the way it played out, yeah, it's totally unbelievable. And the fact that the horrible Lotso gets his just desserts in the end for not agreeing to hit the emergency stop button on the conveyor belt. But seeing them go over the edge and not really sure, what that meant and where that story was going, but then having that opportunity to have the moment where they all sort of look at one another and acknowledge one another and, grab hands. And I thought that was actually a really poignant and a pretty powerful moment. You know, if this really is sort of the last film of the series as well, it really, I don't know, you felt something in terms of the characters there and the relationship between the characters that I don't think you would have gotten otherwise.
I think it was very clever that they pushed the fact that a lot of characters had fallen by the wayside and you were down to the final group. Because I think that's what happens with a school year, a university group. You know, as you get older, people pass away and move away and you get like a smaller group of the original 12 or 25 that were in your year, and I think that mortality thing therefore had real resonance, because you were down to, well, these are the only guys that are left, and even they may now leave. I didn't expect them to die at the end of the film, because heck, it's a Disney film, but I genuinely felt a big emotional kind of connection between them, and I'm glad that it wasn't just a love connection that Woody and what's her name?
Jesse.
It was actually more of a bond between, friends kind of ending. I thought that was really solid. And I loved the claw coming in to save us, because I've loved the whole the claw since the first one. So
the escape route of the claw for me was slightly, if anything, frustrating. But I'm willing to forgive it, because that scene was just freaking amazing. I loved the big key things that made that scene work for me were, the lighting for one was just gorgeous on them, and then the animation, the tiny little tweaks. I mean, let's remember, Pixar, from as far as I know, they're still doing hand animation, and
it's keyframe.
It's just there's tiny little movements and subtleties in their face and their hand gestures, and as they're all connecting, and they're seeing their doom and they're willing to accept it. I'm almost willing to accept it, that they're going to go. And I think the pacing was perfect, and I just loved every moment of that scene. The the
it felt jump. A lot like that scene. Have you guys ever seen the Right Stuff, the Philip Kaufman film? Yeah. There's a scene in the Right Stuff where all the astronauts are at a huge barbecue in Texas or something, and there's a quiet moment where they're watching a woman dancing on stage, and Chuck Yeager is trying to achieve some astronomical altitude climb, and they're cutting back and forth, but they show all the Mercury 7 astronauts stopping for just a quiet moment, and they all sort of they look at one another and they acknowledge each other in this sort of silent nod, and you recognize sort of the camaraderie of these characters and of these in the case of the toys, all these toys and the shared experiences that they've had, and I think it really resonates. It works really well.
Which is just such testament to the animators. I mean, there is just almost, I don't want to take anything away from the actors because obviously they produce really great voice performances, but we know that if you get a voice performance of Tom Hanks or any of the other actors, we know this technically, that they will cut up that individual recording day and lift almost words from one thing for another. So it's not like the delivery of a set of lines is not heavily, heavily edited in a way you could never do with live action because, of course, it wouldn't cut with the vision. So the editing to put those lines together, I feel, adds an extra dimension to timing that lets me say that that performance, while obviously based on the actors, is coming from the animators, and it's so strong from the animators. There is just no doubt in my mind that these are the finest character animators in the world, full stop, bar none. It is amazing emotional depth. And also, bearing in mind, if we look at some of the movements of some of the characters, and especially you notice this with the Ken doll and Barbie and stuff, they are made to be restrictive and somewhat clunky by the nature of the production materials that the doll is meant to be made from. Now, Buzz breaks this because he dances very fluidly in his Spanish thing. But
it's still plausible with the joints. Yeah.
But when they're walking and stuff, they have this stiffness about them. So you're animating to make me believe that that is a plastic toy, and also believe, because it's not, the Mr. Potato Head and those characters, they're not doing gross character animation. When by gross, I mean like gross movement character animation, like we saw in Presto, where you could be much more fluid with the faces and the bunny and stuff.
Well, we saw with the arms of the potato heads in this one, getting up to the Mr. Tortilla Head kind of thing, the wobbly arms and stuff. But, you give them some slack for that.
But Barbie and Ken, I am very fond, I'm willing to admit it, of the change room sequence from Toy Story 3. And that was just delightful character animation. It was superb modelling of costuming to give them the sense that those were big fabrics but cut down for child-type toys. They weren't moving with...
Well, and great editing, too. The great editing with the music. And I really thought, too, in terms of what you're saying about the animation, the way in which the Ken and the Barbie were animated, that kind of... the stiffness of the sort of gestural expression that they were able to convey with kind of that, that molded sort of plastic or rubber hand. I thought that was just spectacular. And every time I saw that, I kind of had a little chuckle, because I had a big sister growing up and she had some Barbies. And I just remember they definitely all had that quality to them, where they looked... I don't know, as if they were sort of, doing sort of like the queen wave, with the stiff palm.
Yeah. And what a way we've come from Mattel refusing to let Barbie be in the first Toy Story 1 because they thought that the brand was too valuable to, if somebody told me that Mattel paid for the production budget of this film, I'd believe them. I'm not that I'm saying they did, but it was such a strong film and they let them go so far with these iconic dolls. But, they wouldn't even let him appear in the first one.
Yeah, smart move, too, I think, on their part. I mean, I think to have a sense of humor about the product and also to be able to, let a company like Pixar use the characters in that way and create characters that, I think, will sort of go down in the pantheon of great Pixar animated characters. It's free advertising. I can't imagine they wouldn't want to do it. Maybe it's not free advertising, but
Bo Peep in the first film was meant to be Barbie and they couldn't get permission. And in the second film, of course, it was Tour Guide Barbie. And that was great, but still it was almost like a contained thing, whereas in this one it was front and center. And that Ken doll, images of hardened animators sticking them on top of their shelf with the best of the Star Wars figurines. So, yeah.
I'd love to see some of the animators' outtakes that were done for this film. I bet they'd be really great.
Yeah. So do we have any other technical aspects that we want to touch on? We've touched on the terrific particle work, and I think you've rightly singled that out. I think the texturing of the background elements was strong. In terms of lighting, it still felt Toy Story-esque, though I think it did lift at a level, and certainly on some of the environmental fog type stuff.
Well, I think we're missing one big part of the animation. With obviously, it's tricky making an inner object come alive, but the animation of the humans was also terrific. I loved the scene where Andy's sitting in his chair, slouched in his chair, and he's looking over at the box, and he wheels himself up to the box using his feet, and his movements are exactly what a teenager would do. And
I remember that exact scene, and I remember thinking the same thing. I'd completely forgotten. I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah, that when he moved over to the box, that had such a human feel to the performance.
And I think it's harder to animate humans because, you know, we know what a human look like. We know what we need to register as a human, and for that, I think they just really nailed that shot.
They're still stylized, but yeah, definitely the ones in Wall-E were a bit of a disappointment in terms of technical for me, because they were so stylized that it didn't quite feel as appropriate. But yeah, no, I think I still think these were stylized. But
certainly, yeah, they had to stay true to, you know, the first characters we saw, you know, 11 years ago.
Was good. The daughter that got the toys at the end. And another character that I thought was a great gag, digressing, I know, from your point, is the dog 10 years on.
Yeah, I thought, you know, that's funny that you bring that up. I thought that was a great gag, the dog 10 years on. But I'll be honest, I actually felt like the dog in particular, stylistically, I don't know. And I, looking back at the previous films, too, I think this was also the case. There's something about the design aesthetic of the dog that it just feels to me like it's sort of from another project. Like it doesn't quite fit.
Yeah, you know,
there's something odd about that.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with you now you mention it, though. I think I felt the same way when I saw the dog last time. I think they probably got trapped in some look.
Yeah. I think that's the look that they were stuck with from the first one. I mean, yeah, obviously, back then it was easier to do toys than humans. And
hair was particularly a problematic thing.
Lutzo's fur was terrific.
And I have a dachshund, too, so you know I can't help but take offense to the fat wiener dog. I don't know if that's really something we should be making fun of.
Yeah. So there was, of course, just before we leave it, where there was a lot of in-jokes in this. So I'm going to flag whether you guys had any in-jokes. My favorite in-joke was the Pizza Planet van. I always enjoy seeing it driving around.
I didn't see that one.
Yes, yes. About three quarters of the way through, when they're out on the street, the Pizza Planet.
I'll be watching it again, so I'll keep an eye out for that.
The license plate of the car that they go off in at the beginning,
yep,
is the license plate of the animation room at, was it Cal Arts? Where they
Cal
studied
Arts,
at, yeah,
yeah,
Cal Arts studied University. That's a good one. Was there any other in-jokes you guys liked?
The Mac keyboard at the end where the two dinosaurs are playing the video game. They've got the shiny Mac.
Oh, really? I missed that.
A USB keyboard. That's in there. I think there was another Apple joke in there as well, which popped up. I can't remember what it was.
There's been no better Apple joke than the reboot sound on Wall-E.
I love that.
Yeah.
That was beyond insanely brilliant. I think that's always fun spotting the Luxo lamps and, of course, the ball from
Luxo
Jr.
In the sand pit near the end.
Yeah.
And oh, yeah, the ball at the end I saw.
Yeah. Somebody's meticulously gone through the film and found about 50 of these things, right down to characters and notes on the walls of the pinboards. There's actually a pinboard postcard from Ellie and what's his name from Up?
You know, cool.
What's Carl? Carl, is it? Yeah. Carl and Ellie. Yep. There's a postcard from them from some vacation on the pinboard in the shop. So this is in the kids center. So there's just a ton of that stuff. And I love that kind of stuff. I mean, it's the sort of stuff that you know, again, it's just somebody loving it and taking that much attention to detail to produce stuff is great. There's either a sticker or a shot of one of the upcoming Cars 2 characters that's also in there.
Oh, cool. Which is also they always like linking those because, you know, the Hugalot Bear was actually in Up. He was in the little girl's room as the house leaves the city. He was tucked away in the corner.
Did you guys see the viral marketing campaign that Pixar did for the bear?
I love that. I was so hoping that would that. I was so hoping that would be in there, but I couldn't figure out how they're going to link the two. Well, there's a whole heap of ads. You can see them on YouTube and stuff. They're ads from the 80s, basically, and they've even got the VHS tape creases and everything for the Hugalot bear. I've seen two. There's an American version and also a Japanese version, and they are just awesome. It's kind of like the in Wall-E, you know, when they switch back to the human ad. Yeah, so it's that kind of thing. So I couldn't figure out how they were going to put real humans into the Toy Story film, but you know, they're great little films by themselves. It's just like a 30-second ad with a Hugalot bear.
It's not Hugalot, it's
Lotso. Sorry. Lotso hugs. Hugalot.
But twice it was looking like you were just being provocative.
Yeah, I have to say another thing too that I really enjoyed was the sort of tip of the hat to Miyazaki with the Totoro.
Yes, that was wicked.
Stuffed animal. I thought that was really neat. It stuck out like a sore thumb, but at the same time, it was kind of neat to see that in there. You know, just sort of paying respects to the master. I thought that was pretty great.
Matt, thank you so much for going down. I mean, it's hard to critique a film that we find so little wrong with, but I don't think we're alone. Hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank and building. It's probably going to be the film of the summer. And I think Pixar, you know, once again, knocked it out of the park. It's by no means a given that anyone can make 11 hit films in a row, and that every time they make a film, it is in the top 10 films of that year that it comes out in. It's an unprecedented move in terms of commercial success, but also just creatively. It's just a gorgeous, wonderful film that we'd recommend if you haven't already seen it. I'm sure you guys have. Matt, where can people track you down, find you, other than just stalking you? What's a good place to see what you're up to?
You can find me on the Twitters. I'm Matt Wallin, W-A-L-L-I-N, two T's in Matt. Or you can go to, I've got a site, mattwallin.com, that kind of has all my, from teaching to whatever effects work I've been doing and or any sort of independent projects that I'm working on.
Excellent. And, of course, you'll find me over at FX Guide. I really do want to thank you, Matt, for joining us, because it's great to have you on the show, adding your perspective, and hopefully you'll come back and join us for future shows, because we'd love to have you on. Tell me just
before
you go.
Yeah, I would love
to. Just before you go, what are you actually teaching? Just tell us what the...
I teach three courses a semester. I'm currently on summer break, which is one of the great aspects of teaching, so I'm being essentially a full-time dad this summer, which is awesome. But when I'm teaching, I teach a 3D computer graphics class for illustrators. And then I teach another second semester 3D graphics class. I occasionally do a compositing class every other semester. And then this fall, I'm going to be doing my first, which I'm actually really excited about, a digital photography / cinematography class, which I haven't done yet, but I think that'll be really exciting.
Yes, I'm doing something similar myself, heading over to America to shoot in Yellowstone in about 2 or 3 weeks.
So, oh, fantastic.
And Matt, I normally would thank you, but you're here, so thanks.
You're welcome, not a problem.
You thank Todd.
Yeah, big thanks to Todd Skoulton, who's always in the back doing all the research and making wonderful dossiers for us, and you know, big up for Todd, and I'm looking forward to catching up with Todd at SIGGRAPH.
Yeah. Matt, are you going to be at SIGGRAPH?
Yes, I will.
Excellent. Well, hopefully we'll...
Indeed.
You'll let us buy you vast amounts of tequila there and catch up.
A fantastic plan.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, guys, for listening, and I'll leave with a quote from Hemi the Pig Bank when he says, come on, guys, let's see how much we're going for now on eBay. Until next time, see you.